That was impressive, very impressive, both talks. Tour de force through forceful architectures or plans, forcible plans. It's very quite hard to get to a question here. something which I found striking is how both in the Canadian case and in the Italian cases you've been presenting, that there is, as you said at the very end of your talk, that there was this the importance of these of this kind of monumental of this increasingly monumental task, building task, or the designer's task of the university was that it was a public. That it was a public commission. These weren't private, privately commissioned and built architectures, but those. To be meant to stay in the public realm, and that this turn, this kind of turn towards the self, towards the self-referential, nature of the project towards the end of the 70s or during the 70s was this kind of escape from the embrace of the private sphere, of the embrace of the corporate sphere, and the already becoming corporate of the university at that time, and more and more. I was wondering how the very public character of these tasks is kind of actually manifested in the architecture, because in a certain way, looking through these hallways in of Lethbridge, for example, you of course immediately think of airports, for example, lounge areas in airports, etc. So on a formal level, on the level in which these spaces are designed, there's not that much of a difference between. Airports have also been very much public efforts at the time still, but it's not that much of a distinction can be made between more commercial uses and more commercial corporate architectures and these educational architectures of a profoundly public nature. So how is the rhetoric, can it or should it be separated from the actual built architecture, or is there a tension between what is being said about the architecture by the architects, by the planners, and by those who are criticizing these designs and the actual built buildings in their non-descriptiveness?
Yeah, maybe I could try to. I don't know if I answered that, but. If we look at the trajectory of what happened after those projects and we look at them today, of course, we could say that a lot of the ideas have been sort of interiorized and neutralized and turned upside down quite a bit. The interesting thing, I think, of this event in general is to look at the moment in which education, higher education in particular, was being used as a testing ground for ideas. And as you're saying, today it is becoming increasingly difficult to tell the difference between a university space or any other corporate space. This actually was exactly the topic that I addressed in another conference a couple of days ago, which was called Corporation Takes Command, looking at the contemporary situation somehow. So today, I don't even know if universities are really working, architecturally speaking, as testing grounds for any new ideas, or are sort of, pardon the word, re-vomiting back always the same ideas and same terminology that has become such a cliché that we can no longer bear with it, basically. Then, if I were to answer what is the public representation of that, probably it's a stupid answer, but in Italy, I would say, is the image of something that doesn't work. So it's an image where you don't have toilet paper in the toilets of a public building. And that's somehow, even if it can be, it can sound anecdotal, it is quite a big difference with the fact that the contemporary corporate university is one where everything necessarily works and everything is complete, finished, and looks like it is finished. If you go to any of the results of those universities, are still poor Italian public universities that survive, and yet some of them have been realized partly according to the original visions, and you can still understand the ideological charge that they had at their base.
Yeah, I think it's interesting around the question of publicness also, or if universities are public spaces, because Canadian universities are public universities, not in the US where most universities are private entities. And SFU always insists on it's a public space, and the AQ does actually function as one, even though, that said, it's not in the city center, so people who get there usually have a reason to travel there. But a couple of years ago, also kind of anecdotes, but Vancouver has a really big crisis of homeless folks and of not enough housing and a totally hyped up real estate system. And so SFU also had to kind of incorporate some of these problems. And there was a talk about, so how public is it? Could there be a tent city in the campus university, as they are in different places in town? And also, even though insisting as a public space, the way the university is rebuilding or is functioning, all of the, with donations and public-private partnerships, all of the new buildings are, you know, branded, and every little lecture hall and seminar room has a name of the person who gives money to the university. So it's not this or that, but it's really sneaked into the spaces. Sometimes, though, you have the idea that it's really an open and accessible place.
Yeah. You mentioned, and I think implicitly also in Francesco's talk, it was a subject, this notion of lifelong learning and learning becoming in a way non-distinguishable from any other activity you can imagine. So learning is everywhere, and that's why the university tends to become everywhere, the school becomes everywhere, and the more it becomes everywhere or omnipresent, the less you are able to really actually say what the university is. And one of those architects was actually saying that you cannot speak about the university since we don't know, we cannot design a university or cannot judge the design of a university since we don't know what a university is. And the same might be should be the case then for schools or for educational facilities in general, because education is so cannot be confined any longer to this kind of Foucauldian disciplinary inclusionary milieus, but has become something dispersed, and that's why the question is how these kind of monumental structures that were built at the time as a final attempt to actually build the university, or to assert the university as a reality, how functional or dysfunctional they are or have become already in that time in the 60s and 70s when lifelong learning has already had some traction as an ideological notion. So how do these spaces work? I mean, when learning cannot be actually allocated to these spaces anymore because it's everywhere.
I mean, that was really a great discussion with the students we had in Lethbridge, because there's this really long hall, and you have, as a student, you have to cross this hall, you walk along, and then huge staircases up and down. So how students, what they thought about the campus, how they use it, we wanted to know. And we also talked about that they're, of course, learning all the time and everywhere, because it's all on your iPad, and you're in social media, that is learning because you have to profile. But also when you go to the gym or when you do yoga, everything is learning. So that led to our setup also. But students were actually saying that the staircase, they don't mind it at all, because then they save half an hour going to the gym and being on a treadmill. So it's all functionalized. So the architecture itself had the total function of what used to be leisure, which is now only to make all the other works more productive in a kind of this whole way of 24 hours working.
And it's also maybe I can only talk more in detail about how, for example, going back to the architect's ideas, when Ericsson was writing in the, I think it was in 68 and 69, when he published a kind of seminal essay on the university, the first title was The New Visual Environment. So he was really very aware that with a kind of, what he also pointed out, a kind of the phenomenon of a university, the visual appearance is somehow impressive, how to address a change in society. But then he moved quickly to, he called it then in a publication, the title was The University, the New Intellectual Environment. But in terms of lifelong learning, I think he was, at least in the planning of SFU and Lethbridge, he was very aware that the society, and of course it was it's a Canadian society at that time, still based on, dependent on the Queen, on the United Kingdom, but a kind of open, multicultural society, that he saw some lacks. And he was very aware about the US pragmatism. So he really thought differently how to set up the architectural environment for learning. And I think he was with this kind of agora, so this going back to not only Cairo and the mosque as a kind of influence, but also this kind of Greek Aristoteles and Plato ways of learning. He really thought about that the university should provide spaces where you have a debate. And debating and exchanging between, and also he was about breaking down the hierarchies between the departments in terms of how he structured the spaces. He thought there could be a new understanding of how we approach society. And it was exactly astonishing that he had the idea, if the university as this kind of self-reflective space of learning functions, they could be a model for how to govern a city, and then just replace the politics of the city through the president of the university, for example, because he really had the idea that the universities are less a technical or a built device for aiming at something with, you know, you have an end in, but it's really quite open for reflection. So this was also very much what we discussed a bit when we talked with the students about nowadays this kind of collapse of learning at universities as architectures.
Yes, I think somehow this is very much related to the essay that I showed by Rickwert that was claiming universities the archetype of their age. And his point in the end was that it's not about understanding these as the university is just a fake city, but his last point, if you read the conclusion somehow, is that it can be the paradigm of our age if we understand it as a place where we can rehearse dissent. And of course, that was written in 1968, and probably it was the only obvious conclusion that he could get. The problem, again, if we look at the contemporary situation and how we have moved from that to today, is that we have started becoming more and more deterministic in our understanding of the space of education as something that will have an impact on the behavior of someone, almost to the paradox of that, so that if you read any, more or less really any, description of an architect of their own new project for a new university space, is always about lifelong learning, is always about informality, is always about offering many opportunities in a very positive way, as if those are really going to make a difference somehow.
Are there any questions? I think we should open up. Are there any questions in the audience? Yes, please.
Hi there. My name is Alexandre. I'm a composer here. I have one question to you there, or two maybe, It's more two. How do I start this? You must be aware of the residential school programs in Canada, talking about, indeed, I don't know if everyone in the room is. It was a program, it's really hard to make it short. It basically, it was a program where the Canadian government to put it frankly, they kidnapped indigenous schools, like children from their parents and tried to re-educate them, so to say, and put them in these residential schools. So in the light of this fact, could you share any insights how a university like SFU deals with that heavy part of history, especially since you're working with somebody from the indigenous community and the queer community? One question, and that gave me a second question, and it made me aware of something that hasn't been put light on, that education and learning can also mean a very strong tool of oppression towards people. And in the exhibition, Tom, are you looking into clues, since like reactivating knowledge from an archive from the 60s and 70s, are you also looking into like how that was dealt with back then? And do we find any tools about how education is a tool of oppression as well in learning?
Yeah, I can answer that.
Of course, the residential schools in Canada are very much on the forefront also of a public debate since the Truth and Reconciliation, when this was public and the Prime Minister apologized again, and it's an incredible wound, let's say, in Canadian history, and it's long from over. So the trauma of what happened is, of course, an ongoing social relation everywhere. And so that's why I wanted to point it out, because the working with Indigenous, not only topics, because of course we collaborate with Indigenous people within the university, we just wanted to see how we work in this modernist campus that's there. Is there a possibility to bring in new forms of learning today, and what could they be within this very still rigid apparatus of the university? Because that was, of course, a very oppressive, not only boarding schools, but every school, every governmental state institution was, of course, repressive. And with the term of indigenization, which I also wanted to be critical of, because it became the slogan of many universities, and it can mean it's a cultural indigenization. So we have the land acknowledgement of every lecture, we have dances and drum circles, and that's totally fine. Everything continues. The indigenous students are still the students group with the highest percentage of not finishing studies. And. So there's all the kind of economic and this reality, how cultural recognition is definitely not enough. So that's why it's this really interesting discussion right now, what that really means and how far does it go. And I mean, I have lots of examples where in a very everyday level, this leads to small conflicts, but then which actually really are very meaningful once they get solved. But that's why this project is also very difficult, because there is so many protocols involved, because you know we as a white settler can't just not take on these things in our time frame and in our attitude how we usually work. So it's complicated. It needs to be complicated, and yeah.
But maybe one add further, because I think it's a really important question, because when we started also talking about our project, oneself has to be actually in Canada. The effects of the ongoing colonization and colonialism is everywhere visible in the world. But there are some places, like in Canada, where you not immediately think about. And that's why it's so important also to insist on using this notion of settler colonialism, which is a kind of soft colonialism, and very much related to the understanding of land, very much related to understanding of property, but also then about history. And it one of the most the most cruel thing happened, for example, with the boarding school, within the boarding school system. So this is ongoing because we are still living in times of settler colonialism. I'm just affirming what you are saying. To one has to be very aware.
Yeah, this and your second question. I mean, I could go at great length to answer this. I would like to make it really short. I mean, there is, of course. I mean, it is actually one of the key motivations to do this exhibition or this project in order to find to address the very contradictory and conflictual nature of education as it is manifested in spatial politics and educational politics, and it's and to make constant reference to the kind of science and of awareness of what at the time would have been called the university as Untertanenfabrik, as a factory of the oppressed, and this has been in the left at least, and also in anti-colonial and decolonial struggles and feminist struggles, etc., had been a constant. Constant call to raising awareness of the oppressive nature of education as an institutionalized and institutionalizing power, there are of course great differences between these kind of institutionalized ways of doing education and other modes or modalities of, for example, militant education, which we have been talking about yesterday speaking about kind of anti-colonial struggle, etc., where different modes of education are being put against a colonial version of education, or simply a westernized notion of education in this case. So this will be a constant question to be asked throughout the project. Yes. There was Elke.
Yeah, thanks for these great two talks. Mine's probably more a comment than a real question. I was really struck by seeing on these images of universities as kind of regional infrastructures or kind of monuments within a landscape that are so similar to other infrastructures transforming landscapes like dams or nuclear power plants at this point in time, and that also relates back to what Tom said initially in the introduction yesterday of people as a resource to be untapped, and this kind of idea of Bildungsreserven to be drawn into. And well, I was wondering. If there at this point in time in the early 70s, is there any consideration on the finiteness of these resources, on sustainability in the sense? So is the lifelong learning, is that really a resource that can be infinitely untapped in all regions and of all people? Or is there some moment of, I don't know, like the oil shock, the oil crisis setting in where there's a general realization that there's a limit maybe also to this kind of resources? I don't know if that shines up in any of the Italian projects or in your debates. So,
Well, I don't know. I mean, it might be that the oil crisis somehow had I suppose it might have had some sort of impact on the actual outcome of the story that I told. Probably an implicit one, at least as far as the research that I've done. I haven't found any proper evidence that there was any understanding of learning somehow similarly to energetic issues, which I think is a great point. I mean, it would be exactly a very relevant way of understanding it. What happened anyway is that somewhere, sometime around the mid-70s, a change of attitude really happened more widely within the architectural thinking of the time. And it was really, you know, the death blow of modernism is being consumed in those years. And this project, somehow it is a coincidence, probably a happy coincidence, a fortunate coincidence, that universities exactly arrive at that moment in time. Universities being an incredibly contradictory institution that really happens in a contradictory moment also for the architectural discourse. But then I didn't show what happened to those projects. If you look at, I mean, if you go on Google Earth and try to find those projects, you will see that most of them really haven't been realized, because already in the 1980s, a total change in attitudes of understanding probably the public role of universities, the public possibilities of expenditure, made the mega structure, or whatever you want to call it, and I'm not too happy with that word because I don't think it applies to most of those projects, made it feel like it's something that cannot really be done. And so some of those projects were really turned upside down and turned into sort of very conventional campuses in the end, with different buildings scattered on a platform.
I think that I really like this link to the power plant, so this kind of mega project. Because in with the two in universities, I think that's really a very good link to that. And we haven't really looked at that very closely, but I don't think in Canada that there was ever this real shock break of resource extraction, that there is an end to it. Because in Alberta, they still they have this now this very conservative government, and there is like oil is the only, you know. And I think it's interesting because, of course, science about climate change and all of these things is made at universities. And at the same time, universities are the one locations also in Canada which have funded and donated money from mining corporations, which in Vancouver, it's the world capital of seeds of mining corporations, the really dirty ones and bad ones. So it's this total contradiction which... I don't know where we could grasp that. I don't know of a moment where that was within the university architecturally or organizationally, administratively, where it could find that. It's an ongoing contradiction.
Right, and I think I agree. As far as we did the research now, it's really related to these moments, what you said, like in Europe, what we call from Germany, Sweden, Austria, there was this social democratic idea that we are not talking about class anymore, but there's a kind of social mobility upwards, opening and getting, you know, that you can improve your social situation. And this is really based on education and learning. And this is a really powerful and a very strong narrative. It was actually, at least in these two universities, this narrative was not interrupted in that way. It was more about, and by the way, Arthur Erickson was really conceiving or thinking about his architectures as megastructures. He did not like the word brutalism in relation to the British brutalist concept. Now I lost track. I was with them. Sorry. Anyways, yeah.
We have time for one more question, maybe. Yeah, Luis.
This is perhaps a question for Francesco Tsoudas. There's an urban legend that says that second prizes in architectural competitions are the best project. I don't know if you agree. But in the case of the two competitions that you actually quoted the second prize winners in both cases, Insolera and Samona. Mm-hmm. is that these two projects are extremely different and different conceptions of universities, no? Both. Is there a comment that you can make about what would have happened if these projects had been successful, or?
Okay. Yeah, well, let's say, first of all, I agree with you, and I think sometimes not even second prizes, but even some of the projects that I looked at in my research were even not even considered, basically. The project of ArchiZoom was deliberately presented as a polemic. It was an anonymous competition, and they put their name everywhere because they were saying anonymity is just a stupid thing. Everybody knows that it's us anyway. And they were excluded, right? So I think, yes, the second prize is, I think even yesterday, the presentation on Leo's projects, it showed exactly the results of a competition that was the second prize, was much more interesting probably than what got built. Then I don't know what would have happened if those projects were built, actually because the one in Florence was really, really a polemic. It was probably totally impossible really to be done at the time. It was really saying, you know, was claiming a total critical role of the university, and that is what is interesting about that. So the university being critic about its condition, which is what an academic environment probably should be in its nature, and it was doing it from a spatial point of view as well, by really literally demolishing parts of the city. Yet, if you think about it, it's not that radical because that is what universities do all the time. I think you mentioned the IIT, and your project on the IIT is exactly an example back in time of a university that clears up space and creates its own brand new campus. And the second one by Samona also it more partakes into the comment that I was making, replying to the other question, that is, there was a change in really the understanding of the potentials of public authorities. Generally, I mean, of course, the decline of the public body, the growth of the private sector, and the fact that even if probably those things could have been built in a past when the public was really strong, by the 80s it was no longer possible to build such a thing.
So thank you very much. Thank you again for your talks, and we are very much looking forward to the contributions to the exhibition also later in 2020. We are reconvening at 4:15. Right? Is that right? Okay, thank you.